The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the New York Times, AOL.com, and National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These articles are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to start with an update concerning a popular tourist route, Interstate 40 between North Carolina and Tennessee. It's summertime, so why not take a look at what's going on? As you will recall, Hurricane Helene last year caused widespread damage to western North Carolina, and that included parts of I-40. Now, we have three stories that are going to give us a better picture of what the conditions are like along I-40 at this time, and they're improving every day, as you can hear in reports in the newspapers and television and radio. First, we're going to have Gabe Castro Root's article, Visiting the Storm-Battered Blue Ridge Parkway, as a question. Here's what to know. Now, his story appeared in the June 16th, 2025 issue of the New York Times. And we're going to begin with the subhead, which reads, the 469-mile route known as America's Favorite Drive has mostly reopened 9 months after Hurricane Helene, but there are still detours and closures to watch out for. Now the main article. When Hurricane Helene ravaged much of the southeastern United States in September 2024, the scenic Blue Ridge Parkway also took a beating. Most years, the 469-mile parkway, which winds through the Appalachians in North Carolina and Virginia, tops the list of the most visited National Park Service properties, dazzling travelers with waterfalls, mountain vistas, and lush forest. Despite the storm, the parkway still ranked second last year with nearly 17 million visitors after the Golden Gate National Recreation Area in the San Francisco Bay Area. Landslides, flooding, and fallen trees caused by the hurricane's heavy rain and high winds caused extensive damage to the parkway, closing the entire road for about 2 weeks. Maintenance crews have repaired much of the damage over the past several months, despite layoffs and budget cuts at the National Park Service. Those sections of the roadway, as well as some campsites and a destroyed visitor center, remain closed indefinitely. Now, here's what to know if you'd like to visit the parkway this summer, and he's going to give us a lot of information that may be helpful. Hurricane Helene, which killed at least 250 people across seven states and caused nearly $80 billion in damage, dumped up to 30 inches of rain and brought wind gusts of up to 100 miles per hour along parts of the Blue Ridge Parkway. The storm destroyed the visitor center at Linville Falls and caused at least 57 landslides along the parkway in North Carolina alone. Park employees have worked tirelessly to restore the roadway and its surrounding amenities despite the staffing and budget cuts, said Ebony Preston Goddard, the Southeast Regional Director for the National Parks Conservation Association. There's been a lot of progress, he says, but some of the impacted areas, well, were just really, really bad, Dr. Preston Goddard said. We have to be patient, be kind, and thank the rangers we see. What's open and what's closed? Well, two campgrounds along the parkway were set to reopen over the weekend of June 21st, joining three that opened on time for the summer season. Two other campgrounds remain closed indefinitely because of damage from Helene, and another may open later this year. Park officials established a detour route around a stretch of closed parkway from east of Boone, North Carolina, to Cumberland Knob near the Virginia state line. If you're coming to the area and typically would take the parkway, we would encourage you to enjoy the time that the detours give you in our small town, said Kitty Honeycutt, executive director of the Chamber of Commerce in Ashe County. She said towns along the parkway are eager to welcome back visitors, especially after the storm made last fall's leaf-peeping season, usually a major tourist draw, virtually non-existent. Still, routine maintenance may cause sporadic closures even in areas that have reopened since the storm. Visitors can check the National Park Service's milepost-by-milepost road closures list, updated regularly for the latest information. When will the rest of the parkway reopen? A Park Service webpage warns that visitors may experience the ongoing effects from the storm for many months and even years as we continue our recovery efforts. A spokeswoman for the parkway said officials hoped additional road sections and campgrounds may open this summer or in the fall. For those on the North Carolina side looking for nearby alternatives to the parkway, Rita Larkin, a spokeswoman for the Blue Ridge Parkway Foundation, recommended attractions like the Moses H. Cone Memorial Park, a 3,500-acre former textile magnate's estate managed by the Park Service, or the Orchard at Alta Pass, a nonprofit apple orchard where some trees are nearly 100 years old. Even if you can't drive the entire route, part of the parkway experience is the communities around it and all the things they offered, Ms. Larkin said. And while some extra planning might make for a smoother visit to the Blue Ridge Parkway this year, Dr. Preston Goddard said the scenery makes the effort well worth it. The views are still going to be there, she said. They're still beautiful. By the way, Gabe Castro-Reed is a travel reporter and a member of the 2025-2026 Times Fellowship Class. That's a program for journalists early in their careers. Well, writer Emily Specht is going to provide some more details about the work being done to restore Interstate 40, and her article appeared on AOL.com, and that was on June 23, 2025. As the one-year mark of Hurricane Helene's destructive flooding approaches, crews along the Blue Ridge Parkway in North Carolina are making huge strides in rebuilding the historic highway through the Appalachian Mountains. National Park Service officials with the Blue Ridge Parkway recently shared photos taken from a hurricane relief or Hurricane Helene repair project at milepost 401.5 in the southernmost part of the parkway in North Carolina. The photos show the progress of rebuilding the mountainside to support the road. Rebuilding a mountainside is no easy feat, the National Park Service said on Facebook. Now, according to the NPS, crews excavated the area and are building back the slope with an engineered system for the area washed out by landslides during Helene. The structural slope is finished with topsoil and revegetated, and then the pavement system is installed, the NPS said. Now, this method is called Reinforced Soil Slope, or RSS. This method has been used several times throughout the parkway history. In September 2024, Hurricane Helene dropped up to 30 inches of rain, about 4 months' worth, in 3 days in some areas along the parkway. The Park Service said Helene caused at least 57 landslides that wiped out stretches of the 469-mile parkway and brought peak-sustained winds of up to 60 miles per hour that downed trees and destroyed many park facilities. According to the Park Service, this area is just one of many ongoing Helene repair projects expected to continue through the summer. These recovery efforts are happening from milepost 223.8 to 421.8, in addition to other planned maintenance projects across the parkway. Well, more recent storms have created some further delays and momentary setbacks for part of the I-40 rebuilding project, and this report from AOL.com on June 18th is headlined, I-40 shut down along the Tennessee-North Carolina border due to flooding, landslide, months after Helene. And the writer is Andrew Wolfick. And Dateline is Cook County, Tennessee. A significant stretch of Interstate 40 near the Tennessee-North Carolina state line was closed in both directions Wednesday, June 18th, and that was the evening of that day, after heavy rainfall triggered flash flooding and a landslide, according to the Tennessee Department of Transportation. Doppler radar indicated that a locally heavy rain thunderstorm produced more than an inch of rain in a short period, leading to standing water along the main thoroughfares between Cosby, Tennessee, and Clyde, North Carolina. Now, photos shared by the Tennessee Department of Transportation showed a tractor trailer and several other vehicles stopped in the mud and debris that had overtaken the interstate, rendering the roadway impassable. Engineers were reported to be en route to assess the situation, but transportation officials warned that the closure could last for an extended period. No injuries were immediately reported, but officials expressed concern about the risk of additional slides and unstable terrain in the surrounding area. A nearby portion of I-40 was previously closed for more than 4 months following severe damage caused by Hurricane Helene in September 2024. While emergency repairs allowed for the interstate to reopen early in 2025, full restoration is expected to be a multi-year process and not finished before 2028. Interstate 40 is a vital east-west corridor connecting the mountainous regions of eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina. With the latest closure, drivers are now facing significant delays with detours that may add an hour or more to travel times through the region. Transportation officials are urging drivers to use Interstate 81 and Interstate 26 as an alternate route until the affected stretch of highway can safely reopen. The National Weather Service office in Morristown, Tennessee, issued a flash flood warning for the area after receiving reports of stranded motorists. The alert has since been rescinded, but forecasters continue to emphasize the dangers of flash flooding during summer thunderstorms. According to the National Weather Service forecasters, just 6 inches of fast-moving water can knock an adult off their feet, and a foot of floodwater is enough to carry away most vehicles. Transportation officials are encouraging the public to stay up to date if their travels take them between Knoxville and Asheville. So there you go, some updates about what's going on. And just to reiterate, please be sure to check the North Carolina and Tennessee Department of Transportation websites for updates on road conditions should you desire to take a summer visit and use the mountain routes of Interstate 40. Now, our journey moves from I-40 to an article titled Oasis on the Brink from the June 2025 issue of the National Geographic. Now, writer Tristan McConnell reveals that across the world, hundreds of millions of people have relied on desert wetlands that are now vanishing. In southern Morocco, one community is blending ancient knowledge with modern innovation to protect the oasis. Tristan's story includes photographs taken by Mohamed Kalito. Driving south out of the Atlas Mountains into Morocco's Dra Valley, travelers find the landscapes become increasingly stark until the paved highways vanishes into the desert at the oasis town of Mehamed El Ghazlain. While sometimes known as the gateway to the Sahara, Mehamed and its surrounding villages are home to about 6,100 people. For generations, the settlement has straddled the Dra River, with wispy tamarisk trees lining the road on the north bank of the river and palm plantations spreading out to the south. But today, the concrete bridge built to span the water rises over a dry riverbed of sand and gravel. Tourists still come to Mehamed and drawn to camel treks, camping, and sandboarding. They arrive by the busload and make their way to hotels that offer swimming pools and massages. Halim Safai, 55, tall and bespectacled, with dark gray-flecked hair, was born in the town. Like a lot of residents, he remembers a different Mehamed, greener, lusher. When he was a kid, he herded livestock beneath the dense shade of thick groves of palm trees and fished in the Dra, Morocco's longest river, as it wound lazily through the town. In the decades since, he has watched the oasis shrivel as the rain has all but stopped and the river has dried up. The thick forest of date palms have withered and thinned, and the fields of fruit and olive trees have produced less and less each year. Most young people have escaped for a better life elsewhere, leaving houses and entire neighborhoods to be swallowed by encroaching dunes. When there is no water, nothing green, the sand becomes very strong, a very fast enemy, says Sabai. It takes a lot of land. The desert is pressing in from every direction, according to Sabai. The outer edge of the oasis moves inward by more than 300 feet each year. Sometimes Sabai worries that he might be witnessing the end of the oasis altogether, and with it an ancient ecosystem and the nomadic culture and traditions it enables that he holds dear. For thousands of years, people have lived and thrived in oases, developing a complex agricultural system finely calibrated to the harsh desert environment with its water scarcity and ecological fragility. By some measurements, oases occupy 740,000 square miles worldwide, roughly three times the area of Texas, and in North Africa and Asia sustain an estimated 150 million people. In Morocco, oases are home to 1 million people. The stresses of contemporary climate change are accelerating with increasing aridity, temperatures, and desertification, as well as destructive floods and wildfires. Yet Sabai is an optimist steeped in nomadic culture, and he believes that oases contain the seeds of their own salvation. What is an oasis? Well, an imagined place, a mythical one, an isolated palm-fringed pool in the desert, a place of safety. Somewhere desperate travelers, rather, might find relief or dismay if the oasis turns out to be a mirage. Well, ecologically, it is simply an area made fertile by a water source in an otherwise harsh and arid environment. But human ingenuity has transformed oases into complex civilizations. 10,000 years ago, northern Africa was hammered by strong monsoon rains and the Sahara was verdant. But the climate gradually shifted and the grasslands and rivers dried up. In the newly unforgiving desert landscape, water was scarce. Where people found it, they exploited it and created pockets of habitable land that made life not just possible but prosperous, providing homes and livelihoods to many thousands. Radiocarbon-dated barley and wheat grains, as well as millstones used to grind flour, show that oases were already developing in the Dry Valley during the 5th century. As oases grew, so did Saharan trade. Date palms and the hallmark species of the oases are drought and heat resistant and grow readily in the desert wherever there's water close to the surface. But it takes huge amounts of labor and engineering to successfully cultivate them. These costs were in part met by the salt, gold, and textile traders who plied the caravan routes between Marrakesh and Timbuktu. Oases were a place for them to rest and restock before their next expedition. As Sabai puts it, you can't be a nomad all the time, just moving everywhere. You need to stop, relax. The essential ingredients of the oasis are date palms and people, and neither flourishes without the other. The thick fronds of the date palm's crown provide a shady canopy beneath which other species can grow, protected from the punishing sun. Scientists have described the date palm as a keystone species for the ingenious three-tiered agriculture ecosystem it anchors. The tree produces valuable dates, and the humid, temperature-controlled microclimate beneath the dense overstory fosters other crops, such as fruit, olive, and henna trees. At ground level, beans, wheat, barley, and alfalfa grow, protected from the wind and sand by the palm's tough trunks. Mohammed Eid El-Mokhtar, a professor of plant physiology and biotechnology at Hassan II University in Casablanca, who has studied the impact of climate change on oasis ecosystems, describes the date palm as the umbrella beneath which all else thrives. If we want to sustain the structure in the oasis, he says, we have to sustain the date palm. Oases worked, in other words, because they stayed in balance. Rainfall in this part of Morocco was always sparse, but still the draw was filled with snow melt and rainwater that flowed more than 11,000 feet down the peaks of the high Atlas Mountains. Farming communities worked together to dig and maintain geometric networks of irrigation channels to siphon river water into the palm plantations. They used stone, mud bricks, and rammed earth to build warren-like fortified homes and villages known as sars and kasbahs, and expanded their agricultural lands into the increasingly irrigated desert. But climate change has devastated many oases, and it's only expected to get worse. Temperatures in Morocco are projected to rise by as much as 9 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century, and rainfall to be reduced by 30% to 50%. Extreme flooding is on the rise, and government figures show that around 10,000 palm trees burn every year in wildfires. Near Amid, the palms survive largely because farmers use groundwater extracted with individual solar pumps to irrigate their plots. They are cheap to run and make extracting water easy, but they are a short-term fix. The brackish groundwater increases the salinity of the soil, making growing crops even more difficult, and pulling straight from the aquifer can put it out of reach of even the deepest palm tree roots. As long as people keep pumping groundwater with solar, they think there's no problem, says Sabai, but when you use solar, you can very quickly kill the oases. Abdel Karim Bonnawi, a 48-year-old with a thick mustache and dressed in a white tunic and turban, has farmed in Mehamed all his life. When he was growing up, there were periods of drought that would decimate crops, he says, but the palms stayed strong. Now even they wither and date yields are falling. The palm cover on his acre plot is scant and the fruit trees are gone. Unable to rely on the river or rain for irrigation, he uses groundwater pumped from his own well at the far end of the land, and every few years he must dig it deeper. In 1996, a 23-foot well was enough. Now it reaches to 52 feet. But it's in God's hands, Benawi says. But as I see it, there is no future for farming here because of the water. In agriculture, you always lose. He expects that eventually his three young sons, all of whom are under 10, will abandon farming and the oasis. In a destructive feedback loop, migration hastens the oasis surrender to the desert. The local population has fallen by a fifth in the past 20 years, and mostly young people leave. It's harder for the aging population that remains to maintain the palm trees and irrigation channels. There is nothing to do here because there's no rain, so people emigrate, says 61-year-old farmer Adela Lee Labouche, whose three sons have left. There is nobody around, just us old people. In his long white jibala and purple scarf, Labouche takes me to the sand-filled irrigation channels and sand-covered fields nearby. There's nobody here to help us work, he says, shrugging. Neglected and abandoned plots let the desert in, and a few days of strong wind is all it takes to coat the earth with sand, starting the process of soil degradation. As we walk around Banu, one of Mahmoud's satellite villages, Samai tells me that of the 200 families that used to live here, only five remain. The rest, he says, have seen their homes taken by the desert. There are no longer enough residents to clear the sand-clogged valleys and passages, nor to maintain and repair the rammed earth walls of the Ksar, which are crumbling and collapsing like a sandcastle in a rising tide. One of the few still living here is 68-year-old Balaid Lagnoui, a thick-set farmer who long ago ceded the ground floor of his mud-walled house to the desert. From his perch upstairs, he uses the flashlight on his phone to peer at the sand-filled hall below. If there is any chance of rescuing Mahmoud and charting the path towards saving the other oases around the world, it may come from a small two-acre plot on the edge of town where Sabai was constructed a laboratory of pilot projects aimed at holding back the desert and holding on to the water. Acacia and tamarisk trees sprout from shallow circular planters called water boxes that were designed by Dutch horticulturalist named Peter Hoff. These planters reduce the amount of water young saplings need and act as a barrier against the desert. For 10 years, Sabai has worked with a Dutch foundation called Sahara Roots, planting hundreds of trees around Mahmoud to strengthen what he calls the natural system to stop the sand. He has also introduced pipes for drip feed irrigation, which snake across vegetable beds and use far less water than the traditional method of flood irrigation that ceased to make sense when the river stopped flowing. These solutions, though modest in scope, are all aimed at restoring and recalibrating the balance between the people of the oasis and the changing landscape in which they live. Take the solar pumps. Climate change has made them necessary, but when they're privately owned, as most currently are, people take what they want, regardless of the needs of others. Sabai has been pushing local farmers and government agents to reconsider how the pumps are used. In nomadic culture, he says you need to share everything, thanks in part to Sabai's lobbying, Morocco's National Agency for the Development of Oasis Zones, and Argan Trees is still working to install community solar pumps and wells to replace private ones in Mahmoud and elsewhere so that the water can once again be managed communally and shared equitably. Of course, none of that will matter if the entire population of Mahmoud leaves for better opportunities elsewhere. So in 2016, Sabai co-founded the Jadour Sahara Music School with Thomas Duncan of the Playing for Change Foundation, a California nonprofit that uses music to bring communities together. We asked, what can you offer young people to make them stay, says Duncan. Their answer is to celebrate, share, and preserve knowledge of the cultural traditions of the desert and the oasis. Children attend weekly music classes in the traditional Idu, Nawa, Rakba, Akala, and camera styles. The school has since given rise to the Zamani Festival, which features hundreds of musical artists from across the Sahara and attracts thousands of visitors. The school's new home, the Judua Sahara Cultural Center, was completed last year and consists of two modern rammed earth buildings designed by Moroccan architect Aziza Shawni. One is a sunken amphitheater for musical performances. The other is a classroom with a subterranean cistern. The two structures are connected by underground water pipes. Rainwater is collected and stored in the reservoir. Real resilience is saving every drop of rainwater, says Sabai. A Riyadh-style building for visiting musicians is under construction nearby. The idea was to revive traditional materials that completely make sense in the area, says Johnny. To build pride in the traditional architecture, not just to copy the past, but be innovative. Sabai often talks about the importance of nomadic culture, the need to live within the constraints of nature and the desert's tough environment, but to share resources as a community to not waste anything. He says these old ways are key to the restoration and survival of the oasis in the face of climate change. Sabai started as a tour operator before expanding into environmental and cultural activism. He still believes in the value of tourism to the oasis economy, but he wonders what kind of tourism. The kind that builds with concrete, fills swimming pools with precious water, and tears up the dunes for gasoline-fueled kicks, or something slower and simpler that treads more lightly on the land, exists in harmony with the landscape, and draws on the rich culture and history of the oasis. One cold, clear evening, he reclines against a thick pouf on a hand-woven carpet laid out by a fire. One of his guests is Tuareg. One of his guests is a Tuareg desert blues guitarist visiting the music school from Mauritania, who carefully serves tea poured from a small painted teapot heated in the fire's embers. A waxing moon shines bright above, and a thick stand of date palms is silhouetted against the indigo sky. We have the stars and a fire, Sabai says. We're just the luckiest people on earth. The oasis is fragile, its future uncertain, but it is where Sabai comes from and where he belongs, and he is determined to save it. Wow. Well, real quickly, I want to turn a few pages back from our article to share with you something I stumbled across as I was preparing this article. It's called The Candy-Colored Beauty of Sea Urchins, and these are photographs and words written by Hicks Hogan, photographs by Anders Holland. Tiny animals protecting coral reefs, but they also need protection. And on this page are dozens of small pictures, a two-page color spread. And it says, beneath sea urchins' exterior spines, rounded skeletons called are jewels of color, texture, and symmetry. There are hundreds of sea urchin species, and they're found in every ocean on Earth, and from the intertidal zone to more than 4 miles below the surface. In 2018, Anders Holland and a research associate at the Australian Museum in Sydney, Australia, began photographing urchin skeletons that had washed up on beaches or had been collected by divers and those fishing on research vessels. He created the composite image, and over the course of a week in 2024, had 76 individual photographs, and these are displayed here. Quite impressive. And that, my friends, brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.